So, hi, Anna Maria Alemio. So you mentioned in your conclusion that, for instance, the WIMPs are the best motivated dark matter candidates, right? And axions and neutrinos. So I was wondering, so could you maybe then comment on what happens on the scales, for instance, when you reach like 1 megaparsec? Because I thought that there, for instance, you should have some kind of discrepancy also with the observations, for instance, with the halos. Well, and the satellites. Yeah.
Best motivated dark matter candidate is the one you find in the end. The best motivated dark matter candidate is the one which in the end you discover, I would say. And then, of course, there's a difference, as I said, so between, let's say, the theory exploration of the space, trying to put ideas together, and the experimental route. And the experiment, you have to set out a strategy way for the best, most likely scenario for finding something, right? And then the question is, how do you value a certain input, like what you just said, in your overall scientific strategy? And I think there's many examples where people had arguments which were not perceived as dominant, and still people found something. So if you have an idea to go after something, go for it. And if you find it, then it's great. Mm-hmm. But personally, as I said, personally, I think there is a difference. There's a difference in there are candidates which solve a problem, a known problem. There are candidates which so sort of naturally come along once you think about the symmetries and the principles that are contained in your theory. Or there are other candidates which are sort of, how shall I say, engineering. You can do that. Why should I explain the next problem that you want to solve, right? So this may be wrong, you step, but still when you have to make a decision for the experiment, you have to have your personal taste or some weight what you do. Now in the different data sets that you see pointing dark matter, you can also argue what do you believe more, because if you see these many arguments, they depend in different ways on things which you actually haven't tested separately. There's a difference, let's say, between particle physics. If you do an experiment at CERN, you test all the steps in the logical chain individually and put it together. In, let's say, in cosmology, there's a number of things where you say, this happens, this and this, and that's the outcome, but without testing any immediate steps. So that's why I would say you should be a little bit more careful in jumping to conclusions in that sense, and that's all the way in for your personal strategy, what's most probable or likely to do.
Okay, thank you. Hi, this is Daniel Kincses from Hungary. Could you please go to slide 41?
Is this the right one?
Not sure if this is
the... Let's just say explanations of the slow wave.
Yeah, there. So in the middle you have this like question of with the new light boson, and I wanted to bring up a topic that is connected to that, and I would like to ask your opinion about this. So there is, I think, a very interesting recent development from Hungary, which was done by Attila Krasznahorkai and his collaborators, that they have actually now two experiments now. The first one was in 2016 and the second one is 2019, where they did these like nuclear transitions or beryllium and helium and observed electron-positron pairs with a spectrometer and observed an anomaly. And then there was a theoretical follow-up, and the whole like result was that it could be explained with a new light boson, which is actually turns out to be, after the second experiment, the theoretical side predicted that it should be a gauge boson, so a mediator for a new force, maybe a fifth force of nature. So are you familiar with these results, and could you comment on this?
I know this discussion, as you know, is heavily disputed, so say people write papers for and against, etc., as always, as it should be done when there's some claim, etc. So if there were a true signal, then of course would be one explanation, and you could do a discussion, what else could it be? At the moment, so say, I'm not fully convinced, let's put it this way, so there's an ongoing discussion, there's some arguments against it, but it would exactly maybe go in that direction, right? So as I wrote here, there's three directions to go. and most of the direction. Maybe one is just the axion route. You can say maybe the sun produces axion, or another way produces axions that makes a signal, and that's one kind of arguments. Second is neutrinos. Actually, neutrinos, magnetic moment or other type interact, NSI operator, etc. That could be the reason. And the nice thing about neutrinos is that we know they're there. We know that the neutrino flux from the sun and the cross section in the standard model is not that far away. So some enhancement could do the job. And the third category is light bosons. There's many ideas people have. It's just simply, and maybe I actually have the slides that I couldn't show them. I can show you how it goes. So that's so say when you do have, let's say, the axon discussion. So when you put something in different types of injection, that's what you get from these different ABC, Primakov, etc. type things, and then you compare it and fit it to what you see. Then you can see here up here that you can fit what you need to fit. But then, of course, as the expert, you know, you run in astronomical sort of questions. The large magnetic moment is the next one, so to say. That's here. Large magnetic moment would give us such a signal, and you can add it, explain what you need to explain. That's actually interesting, because usually people would say it is not possible, because such a large magnetic moment creates a problem with your neutrino masses, because the standard model is tiny, and when you do it, when you make it big, you run into this problem here, namely that the large magnetic moment diagrams can be closed with loops, and would relatively introduce a way to have a neutrino mass. And the point is, the way out is that actually what some people have written papers, including myself, that if you talk about these flavor symmetries that people discuss, that to explain neutrino masses, there's actually a class of theories where this doesn't happen. So you can have a large magnetic moment which does not produce these large neutrino masses. So if that were the explanation, it would actually be an interesting discovery relating to flavor physics. And the third class is, so say, the bosonic dark matter. Well, people usually introduce some mass supporting, and for every one of these, you get a certain peak somewhere. And there's many papers, I just flash it, etc. The problem I see with this is, so say, when you explain it then, you have to say, you have to adjust the mass, maybe here, you have to adjust the mass just in the right regime to explain that bump, right? And that looks to me a little bit like adjusting things, right? So the bosonic explanation, even though there are many papers, has some mass and cross-section assumptions, and you have to adjust them such that the peak is just at the point where this effect occurs. While the other explanations beforehand, they sort of say almost naturally, because you have this uprise and this cutoff by the efficiency of the detector. So if there's a signal, if there were a signal, I would take the first two categories as more plausible with less adjustment, where it could perfectly be some bosonic solution, or maybe connected, not connected with what you just said, etc. That's going to be seen. The next milestone, I think in a few weeks or months, you will see the next data release from Xenon, and then we'll see what the discussion brings.
Hi, this is Avni Sharma. So, could you state your top three of dark matter theory candidates, and which theory seems totally unrealistic to you? All right, so let me start again. Could you state your top three of dark matter theory candidates? That's question one. And then the second question is, which theory seems totally unrealistic to you?
It's a personal question?
Yes, very personal.
You mean my personal answer?
Mm-hmm.
At the end, I think it's experiment decide. Right? I've seen in my life a number of cases where what was expected by everybody was not fulfilled. Right? I remember when I was young, people were saying a top mass cannot be heavy, and now it's heavy, right, etc. The neutrino masses people said neutrinos are massless, and if they have mass, the mixings are tiny. There were a number of people writing papers then about large mixings. They all went off the industry because they didn't find a job, and some people claim nowadays that they predicted it and forgot that they never predicted it, etc. So the same sort of thing. Dark matter is a rich field out there, many ideas. As I said, I don't think there's a probability. If you find it, it's your achievement. But for an experimental strategy, you have to put arguments together what you think is most plausible. And that's what I said today, so a little out is there is a good reason. If any, let's say, wimp-like particle would exist, for very generic arguments, you would expect in a certain area of cross-sections, so go for it. And as a side product, all these detectors that go in this area have a sensitivity where you may find something else. And I showed you this long lifetime of this capture in neutrino physics. There's also a topic coming up called beta decay comes for free. There's also a slide which is somewhere here in the slides, right? If you have, let's say in the future detectors, if you have tons of xenon, there's a certain fraction of it, it's xenon 136. Natural xenon holds a certain amount of xenon 136. And for example, in Darwin-like detector, you have 3.5 tons of it for free. You don't spend any money on it, and you can then study how sensitive you are. You're not as fully sensitive as these specially designed ton-scale detectors these days, but this comes for free without any extra cost. Right? That's and so on. So there's the, I think there are strategies. You go for some argument, and then find and go and see what you see. I always call this Columbus experiment. Columbus had a theory, which was called Sail Westward and You Find India. He had a rough idea of the size of the Earth, actually was off by a factor two, and his experiment, sailing off westward, had three possible outcomes. First one, find India, confirming your theory. Second one, finding America, not bad either, discovery, right? Third one, sailing long enough and coming back and finding nothing, it would be a shift of paradigms because the Earth is not round. Same thing, if these detectors don't find anything, you push the WIMP essentially off the table and something else had to come in. In that sense, it's clarifying something. And so you shouldn't put your strategy on your personal taste of what you think the best authentic candidate is. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you.
Anastasia Miluch, Bochum. You mentioned as a fact that dark matter doesn't interact strongly. What are observational evidences for that?
Well, actually, dark matter could be strongly interacting. That's a loophole that many people are aware of. So it could introduce some new particles that have actually strong interactions and make them such that they confine, make neutral states, and make the choose representation such that they do not bind to quarks. So they are singlets, they've confined to singlets, so they et cetera and so on. So that's something you can do in principle and so on. Some people talk about this. You have to be a little bit careful because there's still these bound states are van der Waals forces. And van der Waals forces are orders of magnitude bigger than the weak interaction you're talking about. So always my feeling is that you have to be careful. As far as I know, it's never been worked out, but in principle there's the idea of color neutral colored states, so bound states, et cetera. Otherwise, the usual thing, if you had, let's say, anything that had color, as a, et cetera, and if it would bind to quarks, with the quarks, you would get an electric charge and you would see it. The bound state of this dark matter, the QCD bound state with quarks, would make an electromagnetic track in your detector, and that would be ruled out.
Luigi, so you mentioned this imminent xenon-enton unblinding. I was wondering whether the collaboration has been thinking about ideas, I mean, both either with new analysis methods or new data, whether to maybe discriminate between different background hypotheses or maybe just to exclude some background hypotheses.
Well, those of you that work in experiments know that unblinding are exciting periods. You have to move carefully, step by step. Especially since you talk about a low background experiment, you have to fix everything ahead of time to avoid selection biases. Typically, you run your Monte Carlos to simulate what to expect, and from the Monte Carlo, you define how to do it. For example, this fiducialization, which I was mentioning, you run your Monte Carlo from the known backgrounds, from the materials, you say, okay, that's where the best signal to background is, and that's chooses, and that's it. In fact, in Xenon 1 ton, we did that, and having a very successful purification, we made the fiducial volume bigger, and it backfired because then in this extra fiducial volume there were some events which reduced the limb. That's you get, you take what you get. That's you must avoid these selection biases. Next thing is when you unblind, you do it usually try to do it step by step. Step by step means you open up everything, then you have it, and then there's no way to go back. The way to open partially is to do what's so-called sideband unblinding and things. You open a certain part of the detector partner space to your analysis without the part where the signal should be sitting, and then you have a consistent check if anything is wrong or if there's something wrong. That's actually happening, et cetera, and so on, and that's the exciting part. And when we did this with Xenon 1 ton with this run, there was this surprise suddenly. There was this excess in low ER, which we nobody expected. I think in the collaboration, there was some discussion for half a year, forward, backward, what could it be, to the point where so we have to publish it. And I pushed very hard to say that in the paper we have three options, namely one statistical fluctuation, one some background, and one in physics. It takes time to explore. It was clear that the theorists would anyway jump on it and write papers, but if it turns out to be something else, then no blame is there. And that's what you do. So you open, carefully open up the box, and you try to have intermediate steps which allow you to go back if there's something surprising. And then you open up the rest, and then you get what you get.
No, okay, I was just wondering whether compared to what was done with Xenon 1-ton, there was something, some new ideas, let's say, on some new procedures, some, I don't know, this was my...
There's always new ideas. As, like everybody else, there's people talking about machine learning, etc., and so on. And I always quote John von Neumann when he was old. He attended a colloquium where the speaker was talking about artificial intelligence, and in the end he stood up, turned around and said, if artificial intelligence exists, then there's also artificial stupidity. Right? So in the same sense, it's very, I think this machine learning is very powerful. We have huge data sets in an environment with low background, low statistical environment. I warn you, because if you make something wrong, you get something very stupid easily. But people still talk about this. There's other things, so say there's the way calibrations are analyzed has changed, etc. There's a number of little changes which are important. This is coming from the fact that there might be some new background that was discussed, like the tritium as a background. So we had new methods to detect it. So what we did, I can tell you, at the end, we have a system that cleans the xenon, so to say, right? And this cleaning system, this getters, remove everything, including hydrogen. And if there's tritium, also tritium, with a certain ratio. Now, by turning off the getter and bypassing it, the hydrogen level goes up, and so would the tritium level go up. And it would go up to the level where you would see tritium. So we have, at the end, some data with more mass, where we have this rising level, and they can say something about if it's tritium or not, etc. and so on, right? So there's some number of interesting things in this new analysis. Of course, people are discussing. We also developed a new way to directly measure tritium, which is great, but not yet for the sensitivity at work, which we need, but and so on.
Yeah, so I was interested in these primordial black holes that you were talking about earlier. I was wondering, what are the prospects of and mass ranges of these primordial black holes? And also, I think you had a slide on this, but I was wondering what the sensitivity LIGO has and future gravitational wave experiments like LISA, and right. I think there's another gravitational wave telescope coming online that's going to be a little different from LIGO.
That's an interesting discussion, interdirection. So, as I said, we know that there are black holes contributing dark matter. The question is how much of it, right? And some people push and say maybe it's everything, and that's an exercise that you can try. It's not that easy, as I said, because you have to then, for every single evidence of dark matter, make it happen. Like the example in galactic rotation curves, you have to explain why all the black holes end up in the vicinity of the galaxy, etc., and all this detail. And that's an interesting exercise. The question is, where would you eventually see these black holes, right? And I guess, I know some of this discussion, for example, in the galactic case, you can either think of them being in the outskirts of the galaxy, then you would, an improved Macho experiment would do it, right? Because Macho has limits down to some masses, which is, Jupiter-like, etc., below. And then if you had a new experiment that would go to lower masses, then you would eventually touch that at some point, whatever it would be, right? The other solution is that the primordial black holes are not at the outskirts of the galaxy, but essentially move like WIMPs or Keplerian orbits, right? So you could say, if you make a WIMP heavier and heavier to the mass of a black hole, that's just changing the mass of the WIMP, essentially, and it's the same discussion, right? So you have then all these black holes of Keplerian orbits. It's actually amazing. At first I thought you would immediately see that, because somewhere this black hole must have done some damage, etc., show up by doing something. It's amazing. It's actually, you cannot at the moment not rule out that our galaxy is traversed by black holes going in Keplerian orbits that would make up this this fraction of the dark matter. Similarly, I'm not an expert of the other ones, there's a discussion for all the other evidences, how much you can, how you can accommodate it. The only point I emphasize that it's not enough to say I could have a fraction one in black holes in the matter balance. You have every single evidence of dark matter going and show how you could consistently get to that pattern, because you have to explain the distribution, the production, and the evolution, etc.
Yeah, Christian Döring, hey Manfred. I have a question also regarding the dark matter measurement with xenon. So once I have measured a signal that could be dark matter, how can I distinguish the models, or can I learn properties of the dark matter that I've measured?
Well, that's a good point. So you would like to separate models, and of course when you have only a few events, there's a degeneracy to begin with, right? Initially, when we had xenon 10, xenon 100, even to xenon 1 ton, we actually had a plan for that. We have a certain amount of depleted xenon that was in the gas centrifuge, where xenon 136, that albedizer was taken out for Kamland, essentially, the Kamland Zen, and we actually acquired a leftover. So if you had seen a signal in the detector, you would actually mix this xenon in and take something else, and by this we would shift the isotopic composition. This way we could, so say, see the change of the spin-independent part, etc., and try to project out the operators that usually people write down, right? I guess you know that. This usual kind of argument. There's different kind of operators, spin-independent, etc., and by shifting the isotopic composition you can learn something. But still, there's degeneracy left, and it's just a few events, and the information is limited in the end of the day, but it would help to at least. Now with xenon N-ton, the tech is so big that adding a few hundred kilograms of depleted xenon creates more problems than it helps, so that's why we're not going to do that anymore. Of course, then once you had a signal, then you could go out for different other things, right? Different detectors with different thresholds can be interesting by combining them and so on, and different tech detection technologies, also at the LHC, etc. That would be then, knowing where you have to look at would be then really make people zoom in and would add information, but it would take a long time to really make a clear statement of what it would be.
Thank you.
Could you go to slide 23? Slide 23.
Which one number?
23, could you 26. Go to slide?
This one? No, you did
23.
20?
Three.
That's three, okay, sorry. This one, yeah.
Yes, and maybe this is like a naive question, but why is the muon, but there is one contribution that is faded.
Yeah, you mean this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the atmosphere above, let's say, Kansas, everywhere, is bombarded by cosmic rays, producing pions, muons, etc. And muons penetrate very deep. So that the muon flux down there is drastically reduced, but there's a finite muon flux. So once the muon comes through, so we have a Vita system, where when we see muon, we just cut out the data for this part of a microsecond, right? That's to say the muon can go through. The muon can also hit your detector and produce then some isotopes, which in your detector material, which then can also decay, right? So a muon can go there, can do a spallation process and produce something that in your detector sits for whatever time and then decays. So that's why you have to run these always Monte Carlos, etc. and so on. And that's an ongoing discussion, etc. There's, as you probably know, there's lots of codes how you can model that, and you have to also see all the nuclear physics possibilities, what could happen. Xenon itself is interesting because there's only relatively short-lived isotopes. So that xenon activation not the issue there. The issue would be that you could have the detector material around it that could get activated. The main point actually is the own detector material. So we know that in the 50% of the neutron background come from the PMTs in the top and bottom array, and not actually from one single part, from this little white ceramic at the back side of the PMT where the wires go in and out. That's so say we actually did this development for the Hamamatsu. This piece could not be avoided because you have to make sure that these PMTs are sealed, vacuum sealed, in temperature changes, right? When things expand, shrink, etc., and so on. So this piece could not be avoided. So we know that 50% of the neutron background here in this detector come from these PMTs. So you look at them, there's a certain spectrum. You see for high energy neutrons, you see the multiple scattering. For low energy neutrons, you don't see that. That's why now the whole thing is surrounded by an extra neutron veto to see the neutrons clearly, a veto. And in the end, it's really the balance of all the sources. So the radiogenic stuff is, let's say, the radon that's coming out of the rock, radon 222, gammas, etc., and so on. And, it's onion-like shielding, and it's designed from the what you know about the backgrounds that they've delivered.
Okay, and also I didn't understand at slide 29 you talked about this ratio as one, as two, but like how is this related to?
Right, so when WIMP hits an electron, it's a different effect from hitting a nucleus, right? Think of it as it's shaking, right? It's shaking either electronic shell or it's shaking the nucleus. And shaking charges creates radiation. So if you shake the electronic shell, you produce more light. That's why there's more that's why there's more light associated in these events, right? So then if you kick the nucleus, then there's also some shaking, but it doesn't produce much light. So the light and charge ratio changes, and that's what you see essentially here. The peak strength here, the ratio is different than here. In the case of a nuclear vehicle, there's more of this S1, while that here is less. And that's showing up in this distribution. Electron regulars in this S1, S2 plots end up on the upper side, nuclear vehicles on the lower side. So there's a population, they overlap actually, there's some overlap, and you can statistically sort of separate them. And in the analysis, you do it by, in this naive way, you say, you take this kind of plot where you say, I analyze everything in that regime, stay away from the electron grid peak cores, and ask with your Monte Carlo what to expect and what to get, and then you analyze and convert that into a statement about, have you seen WIMPs or didn't you see them? And as you see in this color coding, there's some events should leak into that volume, right? So this green part is these accidentals that by chance two things happen in detector just to look like it, etc. That's from the Monte Carlo. Neutrons, that's the neutrons which you can't catch. Surface is the leftover radiation from the surface of the detector. And it's all modeling this analysis based on, but it's using the fact that here, up here, these are the electronic recoils more likely, and while this down there is more nuclear recoil, and they allow some gap here to make sure that it's a little bit separated. The red region actually is fixed beforehand by Monte Carlos, and then you open up and you get whatever you get in this box. Because otherwise, if you shift the red box, you could shift an event in and out, and that would be a selection bias again.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello. So I was wondering, so do we have other dark matter direct detection experiments that are searching similar signals in the same region of Zeno? And if yes, if we do, why they don't see the excess too? Or if Zeno is like, it's better in some way, like it has a lower threshold or something. Why we are not seeing this in other experiments? Can we see this in other experiments, yeah, basically?
No, there is actually something to say. There's the so-called Migdal effect. I don't know if you know that. Migdal effect is a way how we could lower the threshold in xenon to the point where we actually can compete with those detectors that were designed specifically for lower WIMP masses. The Migdal effect essentially is that, so say that when you have a hit by a WIMP that of the nucleus, that the electronic shell realizes with some delay. So if you kick it, then the electrons keep going in the orbits, etc. I think there's a nucleus, and then you kick the nucleus, but there's some time delay before the electrons, and then there's some reaction on that. And using this Migdal effect, we could actually extend the threshold for the WIMP detection down to even lower masses, to the point, I don't know if you have the plot here. Where's the Migdal? Find it. That's somewhere it is. So if you include this Migdal effect, then this usual limit, so say, the usual limit extend further. The usual limits, so say, in this kind of plots here, they are from the fact that down there you detect only 1, 2, 3 photoelectrons in your PMTs, right? There's really to the point where you get the single photons, right? And then it runs out. With this Migdal effect, you enhance the sensitivity because there's the secondary effects. The nucleus gets kicked, and you get more light because all the electrons that react to it, and that's how the threshold can be extended. There's a lot of discussion on this Migdal effect, in the sense that it's never been tested separately in the laboratory. You could say it's a theoretical idea, very convincing, but now people design specific experiments to test it deliberately in an experiment to calibrate, so say, the argument. And I'm sure that LZ and all those detectors will use it in the future in the analysis to go to the lower WIMP masses in that. Of course, you can't go to extremely low masses. Some people now talk about extremely tiny masses just everywhere, high V-mass, tiny masses. You can argue if you like it or not. The point is you can do it, but for those extremely light masses below, let's say MEV, EV, etc., you have to do different technologies. That's, you won't get that as deep.
Okay, we are running late, so I think we should close, unfortunately, the question session. Let us thank the speaker again.